I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, masculinity is increasingly being used as a political ideological test. It's used in some political circles to define who appears strong and fit to lead and who can be dismissed as weak or culturally suspect. That dynamic is visible in the Texas U.S. Senate race. Republican nominee Ken Paxton and conservative commentators have falsely labeled Democratic nominee James Tallarico as a vegan. The rhetoric reaches beyond campaign mockery. Far-right activists are advocating for the repeal of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. There may be some electoral advantages to the strategy, as President Trump's 2024 gains among young men demonstrates. How important to you is this version of masculinity in your politics? Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A growing movement on the American right argues that feminism has gone too far, that men have been stripped of authority, women have gained too much political and cultural power, and society should return to more traditional gender roles. Some of the most extreme voices openly question whether women should vote. Others advocate policies that would favor male breadwinners, discourage women from working outside the home, and restore men as the unquestioned heads of families. This movement is sometimes called masculinism, and according to journalist Helen Lewis, it's become much more than an online subculture. She argues that it now serves as one of the most powerful forces uniting the factions of the American right, from Christian nationalists to conservative intellectuals to MAGA politicians, podcasters, and manosphere influencers. Lewis examines the movement in her Atlantic article, The Men Who Want Women to Be Quiet. She is a staff writer at The Atlantic, covering the intersection of politics, society, and digital culture. She's also the author of the book, Difficult Women, A History of Feminism in 11 Fights. And Helen Lewis joins us now. And Helen, welcome to The Source.
Hello.
Thank you, Helen. So the number to call in if you've got a question or comment is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And I do want to start off by talking about your other article in The Atlantic, The Republicans Who Impugn Tallarico's Manhood. I do think you're kind of drawing from the same well in both of these articles. So they're saying that Tallarico, falsely, that he is a vegan or vegetarian, and that is just enough to disqualify him as a candidate to be a senator for Texas. Is that right?
Well, I think if he was only being attacked for being a vegan, that would be that's at the kind of the shallow end of a thing. You know, there are accusations that he is either gay or transgender, or he has, as Stephen Miller put it, you know, soy flowing through his veins. There are endless variations on the idea that in some way that he is not a real man. And that's, you know, that's interesting to me for two reasons. One of them is that he does look very boyish, you know, in his mid-30s, he still looks very preppy and clean cut. So there is an attempt to kind of link him there to just, you know, not being a kind of full-grown man in that sense. And they hoped to kind of do him on that. The other is that his opponent in Ken Paxton is somebody who has, you know, fallen out with some of his own colleagues in the legislature and, impeached by Republicans, faced an enormous number of allegations of corruption, is being divorced by his wife. So he's got this enormous baggage with him. And so obviously, if you're running a campaign for that candidate, you want to go hard and negative on their opponent. But also the other thing is, I think that having a go at Tallarico for not being a true man is an attempt to slightly rehabilitate Paxton by saying that all of his scandals are just, you know, this is what guys do. They're no big deal. Don't be a nitpicker. Don't be a Karen. You know, only sort of women would care about this. You know, this is what men do. And so it serves that double-edged kind of thing of both attacking James Tallarico and trying to excuse some of the really unpleasant items on Ken Paxton's CV.
So you mentioned Stephen Miller's comments, Stephen Miller trying to be Dennis Miller on a Jesse Waters program on Fox News. We're going to give a listen to that right now.
Well, first of all, I think it is very bold. One could even say brave, courageous, that the Democratic Party would choose Texas, of all places, to nominate their first transgender Senate candidate who's clearly transitioning into a female. You know, when Tallarico goes in for a blood test, when he gets a physical, blood doesn't come out. Instead, soy milk comes out. This man has less testosterone than Jasmine Crockett. It is a mind-boggling choice. They would choose a person to run for that office who looks like he doesn't belong in the Senate, but in a cabaret show. Look, at the end of the day, I have a hard time believing that the people of Texas, some of the toughest, roughest, strongest men and women, the pioneer heritage, the frontier history, from the Mexican-American War through the Alamo and everything else, are going to choose somebody with that much soy to be a U.S. senator compared to a real conservative, patriotic, God-fearing, and truly beloved statewide figure in Ken Paxton.
And so, Helen, a lot of attacking against Tallarico in this critical airtime, using just roasting him. Why is that so effective?
It's one of the worst roasts I've ever heard, to be honest with you. I don't feel that Stephen Miller's entry to politics was stand-up comedy's loss, it has to be said. And I don't think the sort of sycophantic laughter jokes I've ever heard.
Stephen Miller, is he the apex of masculinity?
Well, I also, listening to that once again, I did think, what kind of cabarets are you going to if ever it's full of people who look like James Tallarico? I think I'd ask my money back if I didn't get something a bit more exciting than that. But you hear all the points, you know, that soy is really interesting. And that's, you know, some of your listeners who live blessedly offline lives might think, what's that got to do with anything? But this is this kind of deeply held belief that soy milk and soy products contain phytoestrogens. They contain versions of female hormones that are affecting men's testosterone levels. And masculinism, as I write in the Atlantic cover story, you know, it has this really big interest in testosterone. It sees it as essentially equivalent to kind of male vitality and life force. And the argument is that liberalism and democracy have kind of sapped men's energy and made them low T, essentially.
So it does seem, though, they're trying to position qualities like politeness, emotional openness, concern for the marginalized, that this is weakness and this, therefore, is not macho and is not something that people should support.
Right. It's a really big flip. My colleague Tom Nichols once wrote a very brilliant piece about the version of masculinity that he'd grown up with that he really liked. You know, he talked about growing up around these older guys who had, you know, fought in the Second World War. You know, they'd been on the landing beaches at D-Day. They'd commanded a tank regiment. And you never heard about it until they died because they didn't want to be, you know, praised for it. You just found their medals in a drawer. And that kind of strong, stoic, kind of Clint Eastwood-style version of American masculinity. And this is so different from that. This is essentially saying that cheating on your wife is actually very masculine. It's, you know, it's something to be sort of that proves what like a real powerhouse of a man you are, which is not Christian. It's actually kind of pagan. It's pre-Christian. It's more in line with how a kind of Roman emperor might have behaved. So it is a really significant change. And it's one that's very interesting in the American political context when, you know, white evangelicals have been the absolute key base for Donald Trump, you know, a man who's been married three times, trying to kind of match up what the idea of a perfect man is in America now. It doesn't look the way you would have expected it to even a couple of decades ago.
Well, I guess we should mention that Ken Paxton, a video was recently put out on social media capturing him and his alleged amour, a Christian influencer, not his wife, flying to Iceland for a holiday. And it makes me wonder if that was deliberate to make this video, you know, to do this appearance.
Well, there is a concept now of vice signaling, which is the opposite of virtue signaling, which is actually kind of making yourself appear more unpleasant and unempathetic than you might otherwise be, as a kind of signal to people that you don't kind of conform to this sort of polite, as they would say it, liberal consensus. Another version of that would be the way that Elon Musk gutted USAID. He didn't do it in a kind of regretful way, which is, you know, I'm just going to soberly go through these budget items and see where we've been defrauded. It was no, the phrase he used was, you know, I'm going to feed this into the wood chipper.
Yeah.
You know, there was a kind of exulting in the idea
with
that you
the,
were taking
with the chainsaw waving around. We got to take a break here. We got to take a break here. We got some callers. Henry, Bruce, Renee, I'll get you on the air when we come back. We're talking about masculinity in today's politics. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're speaking with Helen Lewis. She is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Her recent article is The Men Who Want Women to Be Quiet, talking about masculinism, a belief that feminism emasculates men and men should be in control while women stay home raising children. We're seeing this in politics, the vibe campaigning that we have these days, not about positions and about politics, policy and facts, but more about, you know, how do you feel about candidates? So is someone masculine and that makes them a better leader? What does that look like in today's world? Give us a call, 833-877-8255. Let's go to Henry first. Henry, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi, David. Listen, I think all you have to do is take a look through history. Okay? Men have gotten this civilization to where it is today. We're top of the heap. We rule the planet. But you know what? They don't do everything well. I think it's time we face the fact that a man is going to push the button and wipe our civilization off the map. And I'm a Democrat, okay? I would rather put up with a Congress full of Marjorie Taylor Greens just because they're women, especially since she's recanted, rather than a Congress full of John F. Kennedys. You know, now there's going to be some downsides, but let's try it. Let's do something different. That's it.
All right, Henry, thank you for the call. Helen Lewis, any reaction to that?
I thank you, Henry. That was great. I really, at no point was I predicted where you were going to go with that. And that's why I love talking to people about these issues. So it is a really fascinating question about whether or not men and women bring different strengths. I think that stuff can get a bit overdone. There are some very aggressive women. There are some very emotionally intelligent men. But I do agree, actually, that you do need a kind of synthesis. I don't think all male or all female organizations tend to do that well. It tends to exaggerate the worst stereotypical qualities of that sex. So I'm going to say, I would like a Congress that's half John F. Kennedy's and half Marjorie Taylor Greene's. I don't think I do, actually. I think that sounds crazy. But it would certainly be a bold new chapter of the American experiment, that's for sure.
Well, we've seen since women have gotten the vote in the United States and a change in policy priorities that women want the government to be involved in making lives better for families. I mean, and so they have an agenda that I think benefits the American family. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Do you see that?
It's interesting because that's quite a recent view of it. You're right. That's the kind of view that's espoused by people like Peter Thiel, that women will vote for left-wing parties because they want higher welfare spending. Interesting enough, as you can hear from my accent, I'm British. And when the British suffragettes were campaigning, Labour, the left-wing party, and the Liberals were quite reluctant about women voting because they thought women will vote for stability. They'll vote for the Conservatives. And so it depends how parties position themselves to appeal to each different demographic. That, you know, they can stress different values or they can stress the same policy idea in different terms. There is about a 10-point voting gap in the US. So it is true to some extent that men and women want different things. But, you know, those are dwarfed by the differences in race-based voting, for example, or in educational attainment level voting. So, you know, I think there is a point to saying that women having the vote means that women get a voice in politics and they get their say. And some of what the people that I write about don't like is that they think it would be easier to get the policies that they approve of passed if they didn't have to convince half the electorate to vote for them. You know, they think that actually men might be more up for, you know, very much more like more entrepreneurship, for example, that women do crave stability in that sense, or that women are less at home with inequality, or women might be more empathetic to the underdog. And so explicitly part of the argument against women voting is the idea that women vote for, as they see it, the wrong things.
Let's go to another caller. We have Bruce, and Bruce, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Davies, and your guests for having this platform. As a son of a mother and a brother of a sister, a father of a daughter, this white nationalist, Christian machismo is destroying the fabric of our society. And when you have someone like Ken Paxton, who cheated on his wife, who has a second mistress and was not impeached, I am calling on these Republican men to stand up and condemn this authority, you know, with these white men who are abusing their power and women. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
All right, Bruce, thank you for your call. And Helen Lewis, do you want to react to that?
Yeah, well, what I think was interesting when I was writing this is a particular strain of argument on the right. It's, you know, it unites a lot of the MAGA movement, but there are other models of conservative masculinity that are out there. You know, I think of somebody like George W. Bush, or I think of somebody like Mitt Romney, who was obviously, as particularly as a Mormon, very attached to the idea of family and grounding. So this doesn't have to be, you know, this isn't destiny. This is something that is currently popular. And I think for a whole bunch of economic reasons, really, like you can't divorce this from the attention economy, where saying outrageous things gets you noticed, and from the way that online advertising kind of carves us up into groups and serves us the kind of thing that we think we'd like to see by the algorithm. So, yeah, I personally find this strain of masculinism quite unpleasant, particularly if, you know, they want to take away my rights. But I don't think it has to necessarily be, demography is not destiny. You know, it doesn't have to be this way.
Another caller, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK for you to join the conversation. Renee, you're on the air. Renee.
Hi. I love this topic of conversation, but what I don't like is how Stephen Miller is a genius. He is absolutely the most genius man I think has been on the political spotlight in years and years and years, because look what he's got us talking about. Are we talking about affordability? Are we talking about a threat to democracy? Are we talking about the Iran war? You know, we're in a war right now. Are we talking about any of that? No, we're talking about a non-issue. We're talking about masculinity. That is not the issue. And if James Tallarico nibbles on this bait, he is sunk. His campaign manager needs to seize on this and make it about affordability, Ken Paxton's criminality, the way that he's usurping democracy, all of these things that are relevant. And this thing about taking away the women's vote is a gift. It is a gift. Do you think Republican women are going to say, yay, take away my vote? No, they're not. Of course not. But he has us, Miller has us talking about this thing that is not the issue. We keep falling into this trap over and over and over again. And it is genius, because it's taken away our power. Every person out there who votes is thinking about masculinity. That's not the issue. It is not. Because I remember James Tallarico in Austin tearing apart the education commissioner, you know, with facts and figures, and coming off as a genius. But here we are, trapped in this ridiculous argument of masculinity. It is not the issue. Mm-hmm. I don't care who is masculine and who isn't. I don't care. Are you going to let me pay my bill, make my bills affordable? Are you going to let my bills be affordable? I mean, mm-hmm. Are we going to be in another war? I've got a kid in the Army right now. Mm-hmm. Is he going to have to go to war for some stupid thing that Trump does? That's what I want to know about. Tallarico needs to pound on that, not on masculinity. Ignore that crap.
Okay, Renee, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. The Helen Lewis, is this a distraction from the real issues? Will the elections hinge on this issue?
I mean, I'm going to push back on that a little bit because I think your caller is entirely right to say that this shouldn't be how James Tallarico runs his campaign. If on, you know, I know I am really very masculine. I mean, you know, he's already been out there gnawing on the old bit of brisket and turkey leg. And, you know, I think if you're a Democrat, you absolutely keep talking about the issues that people care about. What I would say is it does matter because it infects how decision making is made. And for me as a commentator, I'm not a politician. I am going to talk about it because I do think it matters. And I think that's very different to how elected politicians should be running their campaigns. I'm, thank God, not an elected politician, nor am I running for office. And if you think about something like the war in Iran, that is entirely, you know, bound up with the idea that both Trump and his defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, have an idea that the army is the most excitingly masculine macho thing. And being commander of the army and being commander in chief is the most, you know, prestigious thing you have. Pete Hegseth has a vision of the army in which he doesn't think women should be in combat roles. He thinks that, you know, our soldiers shouldn't have beards. So he's bringing to his political decisions around that war a whole bunch of baggage about masculinity and his version of it. So I think that's the bit. Even if you don't care about this issue per se, I think you have to look at how it affects all of these other decisions. And, you know, to go back to the cost of living, it absolutely affects the idea that, you know, should women be given maternity leave? You know, should they be given, should we be getting kind of sickness leave? That's all kind of bound up in the idea that it is masculine to be bootstrapping and not rely on quote unquote government handouts. So this prism does affect loads of other issues that maybe are more immediately pressing to people.
With the war in Iran, we've heard the false accusation that the new Ayatollah is gay. So even in when it comes to waging war, this vibe has currency.
Yeah, and you know that seems to me to be a fairly obvious way to try and turn the Iranian people against him as a kind of bit of, you know, who knows whether it's true or not. But you know, the same is also true of you know, James Tallarico. To me, it doesn't matter whether or not he's gay, but the accusation is there to say that he's not a real man. So it brings in that kind of homophobia too. And yeah, I can understand people thinking that this is an irrelevance, and I do get that, but I think it is a kind of deep underlayer that floats below a lot of other stuff that you're seeing on the surface. And if you don't understand, for example, I write in my cover story about empathy, and there is a masculinist hatred of empathy. And you saw this play out in the immigration protests in Minnesota, you know, where the idea was that it's feminine to feel sorry for Somali Americans who are getting rounded up, for people who are being deported illegally. That is feminine empathy, and that is weakness. And so, if you care about those issues, you should care about the gendered way in which they're discussed.
And so I mentioned vibe, how important vibes are these days, and it seems like that's what the country is running on. Are they trying to control the vibes when it comes to how people decide who they're going to vote for?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a feeling that for lots of men, they don't want to be associated with a women's party. You know, the phrase that's often used online is kind of the girls' party. The way that J.D. Vance put it was that, you know, the Democrats are the party of the childless cat lady. And there is obviously Republican calculation that is kind of repellent to young men with pretty traditional gender roles, particularly from Black and Hispanic backgrounds. So the vibe does matter. Look at the cage fighting match in the White House, which was all about masculinity. It was guys tearing chunks out of each other and, you know, military bands and, you know, monster truck racing. It determined to, you know, to convey a particular form of kind of, here is American right-wing masculinity. And the Democrats, by contrast, you know, were having pride events at the White House. And that's deemed to be, well, that's their sensibility. That's a much more feminine sensibility. So men, you shouldn't want that. It's emasculating for you to vote for that party.
And if you can lock down the vibe that this candidate is somehow suspect because he doesn't eat meat, even though he does, then you may have won.
But it comes back to a really potent accusation in politics, which is that, you know, someone else is weak. And generally, we do like our politicians to be strong. And whether you see that splitting, you know, is that a male quality or not, is up for debate. But I interviewed Gavin Newsom, the California governor, earlier this year, and he's obviously planning to run for president. And he said that one of the things he'd really learned from Bill Clinton was this line about American voters would rather have a politician who is strong and wrong but than weak and right. And that hasn't totally, you can see that in his strategy for combating Donald Trump online. You know, he has been equally as swearing and aggressive and mean about his appearance and dismissive. And he's decided that what voters want is somebody to take the fight to Trump in Trumpian terms. You know, they don't want somebody to, what's that great Obama phrase, you know, when they go low, we go high. No, they expect their politicians now to go low again. So, you know, this has changed the Democrat Party as much as this masculinity has changed the Republican Party.
And as Renee brings up, when we're strong and wrong, how much wrong can people tolerate before that's no longer the calculus they're going to go through when they're in the voting booth? We're going to take another break here. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255. We'll get a Washington and Randall on the air when we come back from the break. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. How important is testosterone in today's world of politics? Masculinity is increasingly being used as a political ideological test, trying to siphon out, trying to figure out which candidate is strong. They appear strong. They put out AI images of themselves as these action heroes when in fact they are obese and they wear makeup, you know, but then they're able to project this image and then they cast everyone else. They dismiss them as weak or culturally suspect. We're talking about that today with Helen Lewis. She is a reporter for The Atlantic and author of several books. And she has also written the article for The Atlantic, The Men Who Want Women to Be Quiet. You can call in 833-877-8255. And let's go to Randall. And Randall, you're on the air.
Well, I'm going to first push back on Renee because he asked if all this is an issue. And I've got to say, yes, it is an issue because Republican and Christian nationalist women are loudly, proudly proclaiming online, I don't vote. I let my husband vote for me. Affordability, which household is more financially stable, the one-income household or the two-income household? And as far as war goes in our defense, how many strong, skilled, confident women are being held back in the military simply because of, well, what they have between their legs? That's not only an insult to the women, but it's an insult to the rest of us, because aren't we getting a lower quality defense product for our tax dollars? It's there. Now, my question for Ms. Lewis, how much of this is connected to, well, is this the political division of the manosphere red pill complex that we've been reading about for 15, 20 years? That's all.
All right, Randall. So there is a infrastructure for this type of messaging, the manosphere, the podcast, Joe Rogan and others. Is this a strategy that works and communicates to enough of the base to make a difference at the polls? Helen Lewis.
Thanks, Randall. I think that's a really good question. I specifically use the word masculinism to differentiate this from the manosphere, which I think of as people like Andrew Tate, you know, who's a self-proclaimed pimp, or Myron Gaines of the Fresh and Fit podcast. You might have seen him in the Louis Theroux Netflix documentary on the manosphere. And these guys are more like kind of cultural entrepreneurs who are hopping onto something that is very popular online and kind of maximizing their own audience and, in some cases, you know, revenues from chasing, you know, what is the kind of popular thing that is rewarded from that. And that's a slightly more cynical, I think, version of this than the people I interviewed, who are more likely, you know, some of them are very attention seeking, absolutely, but they do have a set of ideas behind them. And they do have a kind of ideology that in some cases, like the Christian nationalist pastor Doug Wilson, you know, they've been talking and writing about for well over 25 years at this point. So yeah, I think of them as the kind of the manosphere are kind of the sort of shock troops, who go out and say outrageous things for kind of clicks and attention. And behind them are these masculinist thinkers who, you know, are working on what a policy program would look like to enact their preferred version of America.
Well, the caller brought up Pete Hegseth and the military and this idea, and you had the phrase strong and wrong, and I couldn't help but think about this problem that we have here locally. Lackland Air Force Base is here in San Antonio, and Pete Hegseth, apparently strong and wrong means masculinity means you don't need to be vaccinated against the flu. And we've had a flu outbreak among trainees, and because of this ruling that they made. And is that being vaccinated, is that also a weakness in this sphere?
I think that is. If you look at a lot of MAHA, you know, the Make America Healthy Again movement that's flourished under Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at Health and Human Services, because that has a very distinct approach to health, which is essentially that conventional medicine is kind of, you know, giving in to the man. And vaccines are kind of part of that. You know, why would you let the government tell you what to put in your arm? You should instead go on the internet and do your own research. And, you know, maybe you'll come back with ivermectin, which was a deworming drug, or colloidal silver, or whatever it might be. You know, these untested, unproven treatments instead. And a lot of that goes back to the idea that it is unmanly to admit any kind of weakness, that you might ever need any help. Even when it's your immune system that might need the help, you know, that's kind of humbling to have to need that. You know, if you're a healthy kind of person, then you would never get ill of the coronavirus seriously. And, you know, you can see that in the fact that, you know, Trump was very lax about coronavirus restrictions and sure enough caught coronavirus. And sure enough, because he's a guy in his 70s, you know, got it very, very badly. And it was very interesting to me to see the difference between where I live, where there was a really broad bipartisan consensus on vaccination, versus America, where it became a very sharply partisan issue very, very quickly.
Let's go to another caller. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What do you think about this masculinity as part of having political currency these days? Let's go to Washington. And Washington, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you? I have a question about at what point of history or this trajectory we have seen that being a gentleman, being educated, being having consideration of others became synonymous of weakness. Like, this is like when you were in high school and the bully is attacking you and like they feel like that's the right way to go. It feels like we're in high school 2.0 or 10.0, whatever that is. But how can we do in society to teach our young men and women and everybody to respect and see the strength that that brings? Because communication is key right now. And I actually agree a little bit with the past caller where he was talking about, like, they're making us talk about something that is distracting us from the real problems that they are causing. But to me, that's a strategy, but it's so much confusion, it's so much misguidance, and I feel like our society is just getting weakened and weakened because we don't have the proper structure to deal with that, these kind of situations. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your call, Washington. So has this view, is this a new view? Has this changed? Because Washington brings up the fact that a while back, this was not the way men were expected to carry themselves. Gentlemen were strong, but also had empathy.
Yeah, I mean, you go back to the idea on the Titanic, you know, women and children first. I don't think that is something that you would see in lots of the parts of the MAGA movement. That would be considered to be kind of, you know, sort
woke.
Of stupid. Well, but it's a bit like, it makes me think of the fact that, you know, my editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, had a brilliant story about Trump saying that all the war dead in, I think, Arlington Cemetery, you know, they were suckers and losers. You know, who would go to fight for, you know, and risk dying? And what was in it for them, essentially? That's his kind of worldview around that stuff. And I think that's a real shame, because there is something really, a really positive version of masculinity, as far as I see it, is the idea of being a protector. You're really strong, and instead of being a bully, you are somebody who looks after other people. That is the great gift that you've been given in your strength. And that, to me, is really positive. I did a BBC series where I looked at various things, and one of the things I did for it was an episode about masculinity, where I went to a Brazilian jiu-jitsu class, and it was really interesting, because I talked to older guys who had really, you know, lived a life, been through some tough things. And one of the things they were really passionate about was getting young men into combat sports, martial arts, because as a way of saying, you've got all this energy and you've got this capacity for violence within you. And, you know, you should channel this and be disciplined about it. And you can turn it into this sport that is kind of, you know, physics in real time. You know, this is something that instead of going out and going to a bar and getting in a fight, learn, like, master this. And I thought that was kind of unexpectedly moving and extremely positive as a vision for young men, I thought.
Well, what about the idea of, you know, the John Wayne idea of masculinity, where, you know, if the strong did protect the weak, but also you were a straight shooter. You didn't lie. And you stuck by the truth no matter what. And has the truth been sacrificed in this new version of masculinity? Is it better to lie and hype yourself up than try to be adhere to reality?
I think that's a really interesting question, because one of the pieces that I discussed in my essay was this very, very viral piece called The Great Feminization by a conservative writer called Helen Andrews. And her argument is that because academia, the law, medicine have seen these huge influxes of women into their professions, that they have become less interested in truth seeking and more about kind of catfights and caring about everybody's feelings. So there is the argument to saying that, you know, actually, being unafraid of aggression and unafraid of confrontation in a low key way is something that is, you know, that she definitely sees as being a masculine thing. But you're right. Again, I don't feel that that's a really big part of this movement. One of the things that really strongly strikes me when I often talk to people within the kind of masculinism is they're incredibly polite to me, which is nice and I appreciate, I'm not complaining about that, but it's very different to the persona that they put out there on the internet, which is very harsh and competitive and very much about dunking and owning the libs. And that to me is interesting, that that has become, you know, belittling other people has become so much a part of the idea of power in this movement. Rather than, as you say, being a straight shooter, you're not there to offend anybody. You're just going to, you know, stick to your principles and not be swayed by them.
Right. And this is Texas. And the idea is that you're supposed to tell the truth. And if you ever caught telling a lie, if you lie, then your credibility is shot. And you'll always have to be held accountable to that. I mean, that's supposed to be a masculine virtue.
Right. I mean, the question is really who enforces that? And you have a situation where it's a real problem that, you know, particularly with gerrymandering, you know, districts have become more and more either red or blue. And that means often that a lot of the action really is in the primary rather than in the general election. And you don't have politicians who have to appeal to swing voters in the way that even 20 years ago was much, much more common. And I think that incentivized a kind of straight shooting as well, right? That you couldn't say different things to different audiences, or you couldn't just kind of pander to your base. You had to say, you know, politics is about unpleasant trade-offs sometimes. And I think things have become more polarized as a result of the way that the electoral map has kind of been subtly shifting over the last decade or so.
We're taking another break. We're going to get Marie on the air with her questions and comments. If you want to join the conversation as we talk about masculinism and where is it, does it have a hold on right-wing politics? Where is it taking America? Or is it a distraction, as one caller said? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues after this quick break.
A year ago, one of the deadliest floods in U.S. history tore through the Texas Hill Country. Since then, we've been following up with survivors.
Everything is gone.
And people who lost loved ones.
I find myself just shaking my head, saying, I can't believe I find myself here.
You can hear their stories on the podcast After the Flood, from the Texas Newsroom and PBS's Frontline, out now.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With us is Helen Lewis. She is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She examines this masculinism movement in today's politics in her article, The Men Who Want Women to Be Quiet. And let's go to Marie on the phones. And Marie, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm thinking, let's put these masculinism guys are pathetic. Are they be good? Let's put guys like Stephen Miller, Ken Paxton, the Newsmax guys, let's put them in a UFC cage like we had on Trump's birthday in D.C. there. Let's have them come up against law enforcement guys, EMS, firefighters, guys who don't cheat, rape, don't commit fraud, don't prey on children. Let's have them duke it out and see who comes up with the real man prize.
Marie, thank you for the call. That would be a sight. Helen, thoughts?
Yeah, I think if you didn't like James Tallarico in a cabaret, you're not going to love Stephen Miller in a cage fighting match. I think these are, maybe it's a good job that none of us are in charge of America's entertainment program at the moment. But I think there is a point that is very interesting to me, which is that sometimes these arguments are advanced by people who don't fit the very same masculine stereotype that they espouse. And that to me is kind of is absolutely fascinating. That, you know, not to get too Freudian about it all, I wonder if people are slightly compensating for something that they feel as a lack within themselves. But, you know, I find that some of the most relaxed people about their masculinity that you would ever meet are people who you would describe as being kind of absolute masculine stereotypes. You know, I go to a gym and the big guys in my gym just seem a lot more chilled out than sometimes the kind of the people who are kind of hopping up and down covered in, as you said earlier, like pounds of makeup on cable TV. And that is always kind of fascinating to me.
I mean, it's the guy who just goes to work every day, takes care of his family, makes sacrifices so that his children can thrive, supports his life partner in every way possible, making her feel like the center of the universe. I mean, you can't get away from that. Is what it's all about.
I think the thing about that, though, is that that's defined by its quietness and its unshowiness. And kind of by definition, that doesn't really work on the internet. That's something you're talking about, the kind of guy who just shows up every day for his family and doesn't kind of expect a huge reward or make a big fuss about it. Whereas, you know, we're talking about really what intellectual currents sell on social media or sell on cable news. And unfortunately, this is the information kind of environment we built for ourselves, is that those really good guys kind of struggle to find airtime.
So you write about these fantasies about repealing the 19th Amendment, trying to strip away the vote from women. Of course, that is a big lift. That's not going to happen. You know, it is, and who knows, though, with this Supreme Court and efforts, but, you know, why do they have this fantasy about repealing the 19th Amendment?
I think there's a couple of reasons for it. One, I think it's just a very kind of titillating, I'd call it kind of a stretch goal. You know, you say, well, this is the direction of travel. I'm actually prepared to, you know, entertain this going really far. And the second thing is precisely as a kind of Richard Hanania, the kind of conservative thinker, calls it the based ritual, which is the idea that in some right-wing circles, you say things that are, you know, a lot of people would find deliberately offensive to prove that you're one of the kind of in-group, you're one of the gang. And so kind of handling these ever so, you know, saucy intellectual ideas is seen as being quite kind of thrilling, you know. Unlike normies, the rest of us think, you know, maybe it's good that people should have equal rights and everybody should be able to, you know, vote for the candidate they want. You know, you're a kind of original thinker because you're prepared to consider these outrageous ideas. So there's, you know, I think those are the two kind of main reasons that drive the kind of talk about the 19th.
I have to think back on the women and the men that supported them who fought for the 19th Amendment, because there was that debate at the time if it was actually necessary, if the franchise could be given to women without the amendment. And there were the people who said, no, we need the amendment to make sure in the future it's never taken away. And it's a good thing that it's there. It was 19th.
Very prescient. Yeah, it was very prescient of them. And I think you're right. The other thing that you do see part of this argument and part of the anti-suffrage argument at the time was essentially that you were creating divisions between men and women. You were encouraging them to think of themselves as individuals rather than as part of a family unit. And so some of the opposition to the 19th is about saying liberalism has this idea where everybody is an individual and rights belong to the individual. We don't agree with that. We think the fundamental building block of society is the nuclear family. And that's why we would like family-based voting. But yeah, to go back to the kind of this will never happen, I agree with you. You know, even Douglas Wilson, the pastor I interviewed, said, you know, this is something I think about happening in 200 years' time. But one of the things that Margaret Atwood said about writing The Handmaid's Tale was that everything in it had happened to some women at some point in history. You get the situation in Iran in 1979 with the fall of the Shah, where you go from women wearing what we consider to be Western clothes, attending universities in Tehran, to then a takeover by a religious regime that insists on the veil and restricts political participation. It is not impossible for societies to go backwards. I mean, this would, as you said, be an enormously large step backwards. But in more subtle ways, you know, progress doesn't only go in one direction, and both sides of an argument are allowed to make their case.
Well, what about a backlash from women voters? We thought that there would be some in the 2024 presidential election over the fall of Roe. I didn't see it. Is there a backlash from women about these men and their views on masculinity and taking away women's rights?
Well, one of the things that I didn't predict coming, and I think did happen in the 2024 election, was that you had states where both Trump won, but also voters voted down quite extreme abortion proposals or voted to protect abortion rights. So lots of people didn't see any, you know, disjunction between those, you know, their particular feelings on that right to life question versus their you know, Republican or Democrat affiliation. That was really interesting to me. The other thing is you did see a gender gap in voting. And it's something that, you know, were the Trump team more kind of sort of focused on the future, might be thinking about the fact that the Republican Party could, you know, could really do a lot better, currently not polling particularly well, if they managed to attract more women. And for all that it might be, you know, and they're very excited about running up the scoreboard in 2024 with young men, as Trump appeared on, you know, loads of what I called his Red Pill podcast tour. You know, he was on podcasts of Joe Rogan, Theo Von, Lex Friedman, J.D. Vance did the Nelk Boys, all of these kind of very macho podcasts that are very popular with young men. At the same time as they were doing that, some of the comments that they were making and some of the attitude were driving away young women. And actually, you know, that could be at some point in a tighter election or one that breaks slightly differently, a problem. And it's one that a less kind of ideologically certain party might be thinking about.
I've read these stories about women who were in support of this movement, the masculinism movement. They agreed with it and then they supported it. And then now they're having second thoughts. They're regretful because they feel like they're being pushed out or not listened to. These articles that I read, I wonder if they're widespread or this, you know, cherry picking. But, you know, is that happening?
That has happened. There have been some very high profile kind of defections, but you can see versions of that in lots of other groups too. You know, the way, if you look at Donald Trump's approval ratings with perhaps Hispanic communities, who liked that he was tough on immigration, you know, tough on the border, but have not been impressed with the way that his administration has executed those policies in a very haphazard way, you know, taking people off the streets essentially. And I think you do have this disconnect between where people like the rhetoric with an assumption that there are limits on the rhetoric versus sometimes when that's put into practice and it becomes concrete. I think people can be quite startled that, you know, it's all very well to play with exciting ideas on the internet and own the libs, but actually when real people's real lives are affected, they often feel quite differently about that.
So the 19th Amendment will not be repealed, but there is an effort. Donald Trump wants Congress to pass the Save America Act. He says it's a neutral election security measure that's necessary to protect the vote. But there are people who point to it and say it will make voting much more difficult for about 70 million women in America because their voter registration card doesn't match their birth certificate. So could this be an effort to try to deal with the fact that they are that voting gap with women?
Well, there are lots of ways that voting patterns have changed. And when they disadvantage the other side's voters, you know, parties tend to be a lot more relaxed about them. You could say the same thing about, you know, the gerrymandering, which has very obviously been a very coordinated and thoughtful campaign. And, you know, the Democrats have done it too on the other side with Prop 50 in California. So, you know, or things like the mail-in ballots. You know, we had a Supreme Court ruling this week about the need to accept mail-in ballots. That's been very disputed about who that will affect. But there's, you know, again, as I say, I live in a country, Britain, in which we vote in like elementary schools and town halls and, you know, on like very little old fashioned paper ballots. And there's no real, you know, and our elections cost about £3.50. American democracy is not like that. It is suffused with huge amounts of money, corporate interests, you know, since Citizens United, and really strong efforts to tinker with the voting system in ways that are helpful to one side or the other. And so, as you've said, the 19th, I don't think is on the table. It would have to be ratified by 2/3 of the states to change the constitution like that. There are lots and lots of little voting measures that are designed to disadvantage the people who are currently out of power. And that's something that people, you know, might very well feel strongly about.
So the people who want to push back on masculinism, should they hold up Stephen Miller and point out that this is the kind of guy who couldn't get a date in high school and he's just got a lot of built up incel resentment and that's what's driving the movement?
I don't know whether or not that will work. I don't know whether or not people will feel comfortable with playing dirty.
Could be fun. And
in the same way that Stephen Miller would undoubtedly play dirty with them. But I think let's go back to your caller from a couple of goes ago who said that they'd like to see Stephen Miller cage fight with a nominated representative of the feminist movement. I think, I think that could be fun.
All right. I want to thank you, Helen Lewis. She is a reporter, staff writer for The Atlantic, author of several books. Her latest work on the topic is Men Who Want Women to Be Quiet in The Atlantic. And thank you so much, Helen.
Thank you.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.